Anyway, as I was saying, the point is that to be sustainable, socialism needs to produce enough to provide people with a reasonably comfortable existence. So that's the first argument. The second one is the more formidable one, in my opinion, which is the human nature argument, which consists of several sub-arguments. The two main sub-arguments have been dubbed the greedy person argument. Oh, sorry, my mic is... Sorry about that, people. The two main sub-arguments are the greedy person argument and the lazy person argument, respectively. And this talk focuses on the latter, which basically asserts that human beings are inherently lazy and prefer to offload, to freeload, off the labor of others. Now, note that this does actually link up with the greedy person argument, in as much as the is our demand for goods, the greater the workload required to satisfy this demand, and vice versa. And this also affects our attitude to work, insofar as all things being equal, the more work we have to do, the more likely it is to become onerous and tedious. But anyway, let's begin by looking at this activity we call work as a cultural construction. A negative attitude towards work has a long history, and it's actually deeply embedded in Christian mythology, for example. Now, we all know the story of Adam and Eve. God created Adam to tend and look after the Garden of Eden. Then to keep Adam company, God created Eve, who succumbed to the serpent's charms. And as a result, they were banished from Eden and forced into a life of toil. And that's the key word. Now, there are two general observations we can make about this little story, which tie in with the theme of this talk. Firstly, note that after their expulsion, work becomes a form of punishment for disobeying God. In other words, it becomes invested with a certain ethical purpose, namely to atone for what they did. In his 1992 text, The Catechism of the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul II wrote, "Adam and Eve transmitted to their descendants a human nature wounded by their own first sin and hence deprived of original holiness and justice. This deprivation is called original sin." So human beings are thought to have the same flawed human exhibited by Adam and Eve, and by extension, curse of toil inherited from them. By toil, we tend to think of work compelled to do against our will. Now, of course, it's perfectly true that in any kind of, including, of course, social, people will be compelled to maintain themselves. This is because we all depend on the products of our collective labor. However, this compulsion to work, at least in our present-day society, seems only to apply to some and not others. That is to say, it discriminates between individuals on the basis of class. For example, the super rich who possess more than enough wealth in the form of capital to live upon, the unknown income that it generates, don't have to work. And if they do work, they freely choose to do so without compulsion. And to that extent, you might say this goes to human nature is no barrier to socialism. However, taking a religious angle, are we to infer from this that the super rich, since they have no need to toil, must somehow possess a less flawed nature than the rest of us, condemned to toil for them? Now, if this sounds a little far-fetched, consider this comment by a certain William Lawrence, who was the Episcopal Bishop of Massachusetts, writing in 1892. This is what he said: "In the long run, it is only to the man of morality, that wealth comes. We, like the psalmist, occasionally see the wicked prosper, but only occasionally. Godliness is in league with riches. So this idea that great wealth is God-ordained is something that Max Weber touched on in his 1905 work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism.
I hate to interrupt. It's really interesting, but a lot of people are saying that this distortion is really bad. The sound's really bad. Can you just try and move that microphone, get it away from your mouth? Because I think you're breathing straight into the microphone. That's causing a lot of distortion.
Oh, right. Okay.
You can't hear it, but it's really bad.
I need the feedback.
It's really bad at our end. Yeah. It's just if you're not sort of talking straight into it, just move it to the side of your mouth where it's not, you're not okay, talking straight into it.
I'm sorry about that, folks.
Don't worry. It can't be helped. Just try it. Okay. Just try it now. Yeah. That? Just give it a go. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. So as I was saying, the paper suggested that certain strands of Protestant religion, particularly Calvinism, promoted a set of values conducive to the development of capitalism. The Catholic Church held that salvation in the afterlife could be assured simply by embracing the sacraments of the church, whether you were rich or poor. Calvinists, by contrast, emphasized a more personal relation with God without the mediation of the church, and this encouraged them to look for other signs that could assure them that they could obtain salvation in the afterlife. And one of these was worldly wealth. Today, we see this idea being perpetuated in the form of so-called prosperity theology preached by tele-evangelists, particularly in the US, like Jim Bakker, for example. Anyway, the Calvinists argued that whether or not one was going to go to heaven was predestined. So it was simply a question of figuring out who were the lucky ones. And since great wealth was held to be a sign of God's blessing, this was interpreted as providing a clue. To acquire that wealth, it was assumed this meant submitting to the moral discipline of hard work and practicing abstinence, that's shunning luxuries. Abstinence increased one's financial savings and thus put one's wealth to productive use as invested capital instead of, you know, frittering it away on an extravagant lifestyle and so on. So hence the argument that Protestantism, a bit of a tongue twister that, assisted capitalism by encouraging the accumulation of capital. Great wealth not only implied that you must have behaved in a morally exemplary fashion, it also allowed you to practice philanthropy, which further demonstrated what a virtuous person you are. In other words, it provided you with a kind of fast-track passport to heaven. Being poor, on the other hand, really sucks because you're kind of hit with a double whammy. Not only do you have to suffer poverty in this world, which is bad enough, but you also have the grim prospect of eternal damnation in the next world to look forward to. This is because basically your poverty demonstrates that you must be lacking in moral virtues. And in fact, some famous preachers in the past, like very appropriately named Russell Conwell, actually taught poverty was a sin. So it was precisely this kind of thinking that gave rise to the concept of the self-made man, which began to be widely disseminated from the early 19th century onwards. And this basically attributes the great wealth of the capitalists to their own efforts rather than the workers they employ. What this amounts to is almost a kind of bastardized version of the labor theory of value that's been, if you like, weaponized and put to the service of entrenching capitalism by suppressing the very idea of class exploitation. Now, a second general observation we can make about our Adam and Eve story is that after their expulsion from Eden, not only did the nature of work change, so did the environment in which they worked, so to speak, from one of abundance into one of scarcity. As God reputedly said to Adam and Eve, "Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life." In this barren environment, they were forced to produce their own food, or as the book of Genesis says, "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread," implying, of course, the existence of agriculture. So, in a sense, we can read the Garden of Eden myth as a sort of allegory of the transition from a hunter-gatherer nomadic band society to a sedentary agricultural society. The Neolithic Revolution, as this is called, began around 10,000 BC in the fertile Crescent region of the Middle East, where humans first took up farming. And it was, of course, precisely from this part of the world where the various Abrahamic religions like Christianity and Judaism sprang. However, the transition to agriculture was not a sudden event. It was prolonged over many hundreds of years, suggesting there was some resistance to this change. In other words, agriculture came about more as a result of push factors than pull factors. One likely explanation being that the climate became significantly drier after the last ice age. And in fact, the forensic evidence suggests that hunter-gatherers lived longer, were more healthy than the early farmers, partly because they enjoyed a more varied diet, but also the lives of these farmers were more precarious in that farming gave rise to storable surpluses that could be periodically raided by nomadic marauders, no doubt involving some loss of life. Crucially, it was these food surpluses that gave rise to the division of labor and the beginnings of class-based society. However, in what are called immediate return nomadic hunter-gatherer bands, the very concept of a surplus makes little sense. Mother Nature was your store of wealth, and you simply took from it what you needed, as and when you needed it. In fact, having too many possessions hindered your ability to move around, which hunter-gatherers needed to do to ensure their way of life was ecologically sustainable. Apart from that, they seem to have enjoyed a lot more leisure time and a much lighter workload than the farmers, at least based on the evidence of contemporary hunter-gatherer groups. The anthropologists who's done a lot to revise our perception of hunter-gatherers is, of course, Marshall Sahlins in his 1972 book, Stone Age Economics. Sahlins' book was actually a scathing attack on the kind of sentiments expressed by the 17th century bourgeois philosopher Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes opined that so-called primitive people lived in a state of nature in which life was, quote, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. On the contrary, argued Sahlins, simple hunter-gatherer bands constituted what he called the original affluent society. As he put it, there are basically two ways of achieving affluence. Firstly, there's the Galbraithian way, named after the economist J.K. Galbraith, who wrote a book in the 1950s called The Affluent Society, which involves producing more and more goods to meet our wants. Now, the problem with this approach is that the more our wants are met, the more do they seem to grow, so that we can never really truly be satisfied. The system we live under needs to make us feel deprived in order to stimulate us to buy yet more stuff in a futile attempt to fill the empty void that perpetually remains with us. Behind this is the competitive accumulation of capital in pursuit of profit, which is, as we know, capitalism's main driving force. And this feeds through into the realm of consumption, where ideas of self-worth and status are heavily influenced by such factors as advertising and so on. Then there is the other way to affluence, argued Solons, which is the Zen way adopted by hunter-gatherers, namely to desire very little. As he ironically notes, by adopting a Zen strategy, they enjoyed a state of unparalleled material plenty with a low standard of living. As far as achieving abundance in socialism is concerned, we might perhaps see this as involving a kind of dialectical fusion of both these different approaches, rather than just relying on one or the other. Now, I've spent some time looking at hunter-gatherer band societies, not out of some anarcho-primitivist desire to see society return to this way of life, which it's not possible anyway in a world of 8 billion people. But the point is rather to address the question of what constitutes our human nature. After all, egalitarian, food-sharing, communistic hunter-gatherer bands in which we lived for more than 95% of our existence on this planet knew nothing of money, wage labor, markets, or states. So these things are not hardwired into our nature. They're the products of comparatively recent social developments, commencing with the emergence of agriculture some 10,000 years ago. Agriculture reorganized society along territorial lines, and out of that evolved the notion of private property. Storable food surpluses facilitated the division of labor, the emergence of classes, civilization, and the earliest cities as centers of state power wielded by the first ruling classes to appear in the ancient world. Compared with the countless millennia of the Paleolithic era, class society is but a flash in the pan, so human nature could not possibly have evolved that quickly. Adam Smith, for example, argued that there was, quote, a natural propensity in humans to truck, barter, and exchange. But he was writing at a time when anthropology was in its infancy. The early travelers and missionaries back then, in the 18th century, on first encountering these strange exotic cultures of the New World, tended to project their own prejudices and beliefs onto these people. For example, cultural practices like reciprocal gift-giving were often misconstrued as commodity transactions. The crude anecdotal evidence that these individuals collected formed the raw material on which the armchair philosophers and economists of the old world based their own second-hand speculations. There's a great quote by the French anthropologist Pierre Bourdieu, namely, and I quote, "Every established order tends to produce the naturalization of its own arbitrariness." And so it is with capitalism and its apologists. They seek out everywhere for what they believe constitutes evidence of some eternal, unchanging capitalist essence in human beings. I mean, even the world's natural stock, the world's stocks of natural assets, like its soils, water, and minerals, are designated as natural capital, quote unquote, by these apologists. It's as if capital is some kind of natural phenomenon. Of course, it's nothing of the sort. Capital is a social relationship, and capitalism is a comparatively recent form of society in which this particular relationship has come to be of overriding importance, as the very term capitalism implies. Marx himself explicitly equated capitalism with the wages system, and for which reason he called for the abolition of the wages system. Now, in earlier forms of class society, wage labour was a distinctly subordinate category, and other forms of labour were predominant. However, what all these class-based societies have in common is the extraction of an economic surplus by a relatively small minority from the large majority. Where they differ is in their mode of extracting that surplus. So in capitalism, the surplus takes a money form of surplus value, the difference in value between what workers produce and what they get in wages. In other societies, the surplus takes a different form. This is absolutely key to understanding why work is considered to be toil, something to be shunned. The extraction of an economic surplus is what we technically mean by exploitation. It presupposes and necessitates coercion, and coercion in turn presupposes some kind of resistance on the part of those being coerced. So therein, if you like, lies the seed of our negative attitude towards work. In capitalism, work is bound up with the idea of being employed and all that this entails in terms of being humiliated, degraded, pushed around by a boss, and so on. The anarchist Bob Black begins his essay, The Abolition of Work, with this statement: no one should ever work. Work is the source of nearly all the misery in the world. Now, Black equates work with forced labor and counterposes to this the idea of play, by which he means free labor. I don't disagree with his basic argument, but I do question his terminology, and personally I prefer to use the kind of definition used by William Morris in his pamphlet, Useful Work versus Useless Toil. So anyway, how did wage labor come to take the generalized form that it takes today in capitalism? In the preceding class society of feudalism, serfs were exploited in that they had to perform unpaid labor for the lord of the manor under the corvée system, as it's called. Unlike in capitalism, the economic surplus was extracted by direct military or extra economic methods, so exploitation was pretty much naked and visible. Also, unlike with capitalism, there's no self-regulating mechanism in the form of market prices controlling the rate of surplus extraction. When that rate increased and conditions became intolerable, the people simply revolted. However, the serfs did have usufruct rights to both common land and some enclosed land in the form of cultivated strips, though to exercise these rights, they had to make payments in kind to their lord. And this contrasts with the so-called free wage laborers under capitalism, who, as Marx noted, are free in a double sense. They are free of any attachment to a particular master, unlike the serf, who is bound to the lord for life. They're also free in the sense that they no longer have any access to means of production themselves. Consequently, they have to sell their working abilities on the labor market to attain the means of surviving under capitalism, namely money. So what prompted the shift from serf labor to wage labor? The bubonic plagues of the 14th century, which decimated the population of Europe, ushered in what's called the golden age of the peasantry in the 15th century. Particularly in England, the manorial lords responded to the labour shortages by shifting over to a money-based rentier economy, meaning they rented out their lands to capitalist tenant farmers employing agricultural wage labourers. That helped to pave the way to capitalism, but another factor was the increased pace of land enclosures. Much of this enclosed land was converted into pasture for sheep farming in response to a growing demand for textile products. And this, along with new farming technologies introduced later in the 18th century, reduced the demand for rural labor. Initially, the production of these products, textile products, was mainly based in the rural areas in the form of cottage industries. However, the rise of the factory system in the towns undermined these industries and added to the flow of displaced rural workers seeking work in the towns. And so our modern industrial working class was born. It's worth noting that back then, all those prominent exponents of the free market and its supposed invisible hand were strongly in favor of this. They were enthusiastic supporters of the very visible fist state being used to bring about this development in the form of legislation, for example, promoting enclosures. They also supported repressive state measures to deal with the problems arising from the misery and hardship inflicted on the workers. Despite urbanization, old habits of a rural society died hard. Workers in the early period of manufacturing, still accustomed to directly appropriating the products of their labor, continued to an extent to act in this fashion to supplement their wages. This happened in all sorts of occupations, from shoemakers to shipwrights. What they took, they either used for themselves or they sold on. However, from the standpoint of the authorities, such actions were deemed wholly unacceptable, and this led to the criminalization of these activities and the increased surveillance and supervision of the workforce itself. Extremely harsh anti-theft legislation was introduced in the 17th and 18th centuries, sanctioning the hanging of individuals for even the mildest cases of petty theft. The historian Peter Linebar has described the resulting climate of fear and repression as a thanatocracy, meaning rule by death. The spectacle of public hangings provided not only a gruesome form of entertainment to distract the public, but it was also a means of maintaining power through terror, while ideologically disciplining population into respecting the norms of capitalist property. So apart from legislation, poverty itself was considered a great disciplinary force, or as a certain Reverend Joseph Townsend put it, and I quote, "Legislation is attended with too much trouble, violence, and noise, whereas hunger is not only a peaceable, silent, unremitted pressure, but as the most natural motive to industry, it calls forth the most powerful exertions. Hunger will tame the fiercest animals. It will teach decency and civility, obedience and subjugation to the most brutish, the most obstinate, and the most perverse." That's from his 1786 pamphlet, A Dissertation on the Poor Laws. The poor laws, dating back to the 14th century, were actually designed to deal with the growing problem of the footloose poor, as the authorities saw it, and the perceived threat they posed to the social order. Out of that legislation came the institution of the workhouse, in which the very poorest could obtain the most basic form of relief inside the walls of these grim establishments in exchange for work. The 1834 Poor Law Act, following the steep rise in the numbers of poor after the Napoleonic Wars, resulted in an increased emphasis on discipline. The new form of workhouse in Victorian England tended to have a physical layout that resembled Jeremy Bentham's design for prisons, called the Panopticon, to allow maximum surveillance and control of the inmates, The word panopticon derives from the Greek word all-seeing, panoptes. You could call it a sort of foretaste of the kind of surveillance state we live in today. Bentham himself envisaged this particular social experiment being financed by the compulsory labor of the prisoners themselves. So, continuing with the theme of worker discipline, there's quite an interesting connection here with the question of time itself as an abstraction and the regulatory role it came to play in the organization of work under capitalism. George Woodcock, in his essay, The Tyranny of the Clock, notes that clocks only became accurate enough to permit the addition of a minute and second hand with the invention of the pendulum in the 17th century. You might call this a very timely innovation at a time when capitalism was starting to take off. The accurate measurement of labor time that capitalism required coincided with the transformation of labor power into a commodity on a mass basis. After all, the payment of wages is partly a function of the time you spend at work, and for that you need to be able to measure time worked in a fairly precise units of time. According to Woodcock, the new capitalists in particular became rapidly time conscious. Time here symbolizing, I'm quoting Woodcock, by the way, time here quoting symbolizing the labor of workers was regarded by them almost as if it were the chief raw material of industry. Time is money became one of the key slogans of capitalist ideology, and the timekeeper was the most significant of the new types of official introduced by the capitalist dispensation. Unquote. In due course, this time consciousness deepened its grip on society with the mass production of watches in the 19th century, providing workers with the means to, as it were, self-regulate themselves. This time, time consciousness, therefore, both sprang from and helped reinforce the coercive nature of wage employment itself. Punctuality came to be held up as great virtue of the model wage slave, who after a lifetime of wage slavery was ceremoniously and rather symbolically presented with a clock. Economizing on time was also a central theme of scientific Taylorism and the assembly approach to mass production called Fordism, which appeared towards the end of the 19th century. And today, with the emergence of so-called shareholder capitalism in the 1970s, time has become even more critically important. Following the Big Bang reforms of the City of London in the 1980s, the introduction of computers gave rise to what is called high-frequency trading. This involves using digital algorithms to buy and sell financial assets by predicting ultra short-term price movements in shares, meaning, of course, huge profits or losses can be made in a matter of seconds. So today we are dominated by this linear quantitative concept of time like never before, very different from the cyclical or seasonal concept of time that regulated earlier agricultural societies. The competitive pressures we face at work to cut corners, to meet deadlines, particularly when our jobs are on the line, is yet another factor that saps any pleasure we might get from work. Marx made a very interesting point that capitalism is a society in which what he called dead labor, that is, the past labor embodied in machinery, dominated living labor, the living labor of the worker. Now, this is particularly true of the clock, which, according to Woodcock, was the first automatic machine in history to attain real public significance. Indeed, it was the clock that became the key symbol of the new machine age of capitalism. From the 17th century onwards, you find mechanistic metaphors of the universe beginning to crowd out the older organismic metaphors. And prominent amongst these was the clock as a metaphor. For instance, God was represented as a kind of clockmaker who, having made the universe, allowed it to operate according to its own mechanical laws, much as one might wind up a clock and let it run of its own accord. This marked quite a significant shift towards a deistic version of God, opposed to the old theistic interventionist version. A prime example of those mechanical laws was the law of gravity formulated by Isaac Newton. And what's interesting is that Newton's mechanistic view of the universe provided a kind of template for Adam Smith's later description of the workings of the market economy. Smith's invisible hand of the market acted like the invisible force of gravity in the physical universe to bring order and regularity to the economy. He argued that by allowing individuals to single-mindedly pursue their own self-interest, this would paradoxically serve the interests of everyone. And he took it as axiomatic that two parties in a market transaction wouldn't undertake that transaction if it weren't in both their interests to do so. So by extrapolating from isolated transaction, the free market apologist deduces that the market as a whole must be a positive sum gain. Everybody benefits because the two involved in a transaction benefit by deduction. The problem is this entirely overlooks any negative external consequences that such a transaction can have for others who are not party to the transaction. In other words, it's a case of not seeing the wood for the trees. Now, this egocentric or atomistic way of thinking is also what encourages a purely instrumental approach to work. We see it as simply a means to an end to obtain money. So we tend to become quite indifferent to what we produce, whether it serves any useful purpose in meeting the needs of others. It's not a matter of concern. For example, workers in a factory manufacturing missiles block out any thought of the kind of horror that these weapons can visit on innocent populations who are bombed in the future. They work there simply for the money. And if they weren't there, there are plenty of others who would take their place. So we are alienated from the product we produce and also from the means of producing that product because of this institution called private property. There's a great quote from Marx in his 1844 Economic and Political Manuscripts. It goes as follows. The worker therefore only feels himself outside his work, and in his work feels outside himself. He feels at home when he is not working, and when he is working, he does not feel at home. His labor is therefore not voluntary, but coerced. It is forced labor. So one can sum this up by saying we work in order to live rather than live in order to work under capitalism. Or as Adam Smith would have it, work is a sacrifice we make to obtain a wage. Now, this term sacrifice has a double meaning. First, it can mean we experience work as physical or emotional pain in the sense that, for example, Jeremy Bentham used the term pain when he developed his idea of the hedonistic calculus, the pleasure-pain principle. The neoclassical economists like Jevons and Alfred Marshall in the late 19th century built on Bentham's arguments, but they substituted the more technical-sounding term disutility, P, campaign to ensure that work gets done, without which, of course, society would collapse. This requires compensating workers for the, quote, disutility that work involves. So we arrive at this term, very strange term, compensation, which we often hear bandied about these days, such as in the case of so-called compensation packages of CEOs. In America, for example, the average compensation package of CEOs in the top 350 firms in 2019 came to $21.3 million each. That is 320 times more than the average shop floor worker. Apparently that, these days, more than half the value of these compensation packages consists of stock options. So what really makes the term compensation even more puzzling is precisely that, since what these CEOs are receiving, apart from their bloated salaries, is essentially unearned income from the stock they own, which, needless to say, has got nothing to do whatever labor they might perform. Whether work is a disutility in Bentham's sense of the word, of causing pain, does not, in my view, arise from work per se, but rather the terms and conditions under which we work. And I'll come back to this point later. Moreover, even despite capitalism, social surveys suggest people are relatively more happy, or should we say less unhappy, being employed than unemployed. Unemployment can entail loss of self-esteem, increased pressure to keep up the mortgage repayments, or, for example, having to forsake such simple pleasures as a holiday break. However, this correlation holds only up to a point, and other surveys show that beyond a certain point, the more hours you work, the more unhappy you become. And this helps explain the well-known phenomenon that when you cut the number of hours worked, this often leads to increases in productivity. In short, happier workers tend to be more productive. Now, there's a second meaning that we can give to the idea of workers' sacrifice, going back to Adam Smith, namely that it involves an opportunity cost, meaning the more work we engage in, the less time we have for leisure. Marx himself talked of the measure of a wealthy society being not labor time, but disposable or free time. In other words, time available for leisure. In Capital Volume 3, he speaks of the realm of freedom blossoming forth with the realm of necessity as its basis, and with the shortening of the working week being its prerequisite. Later on, at the end of the 19th century, Thorstein Veblen wrote The Theory of the Leisure Class, a famous book of his. Veblen was referring to a tiny class whose vast wealth allowed them to engage in a quasi-aristocratic activity of conspicuous consumption as a means of asserting their high status, meaning being able to afford a life of leisure. That's what gave you status. After all, as a gentleman, quote, one does not work, does one? So anyway, while the luxury of leisure in the 19th century seemed largely confined to a tiny minority, in the 20th century, the idea of extending leisure to the masses became more commonplace. Keynes, for example, argued in 1930 that increases in productivity would mean his grandchildren would be able to enjoy a working week of only 15 hours. More recent commentators have talked about the working week shrinking even further as a result of automation and robotics. But have things turned out this way, as the optimists predicted? Well, not really. Actually, quite an interesting book worth reading is Julia Child's 1991 classic, The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure. So why has this much-touted leisure society not materialized? Well, firstly, the gains in productivity that Keynes spoke of have not been reflected in wage increases. Since the 1970s, these have fallen further and further behind productivity increases, which means workers still have to work pretty long hours to maintain their standard of living. It's really been the super rich that have mainly benefited from these productivity increases, not the workers. Secondly, if the length of the working week has not fallen much, this is partly due also to the rapid growth of the unproductive sector of the economy, represented by jobs like such as retail, finance, government, bureaucracy, and so on. This sector is financed out of the surplus value produced by the productive sector, meaning much of the revenue generated in that sector goes towards creating jobs in the unproductive sector. So despite productivity increases, the total number of workers in employment has actually continued to grow, as at least in America, has the length of the working day. Okay, so I want now to look at what work involves in a socialist society. To do so, we need to start from first principles and to develop the argument sort of by logical inference, if you like, as we don't actually have an existing model of socialist society to base our observations on. Starting from the premise that socialism entails common ownership means of production, what follows is that socialism must be a non-exchange system. That doesn't mean, incidentally, a non-exchange economy is necessarily socialist, however. Karl Polanyi, for example, cites the example of what he calls a redistributive system, which is really based on a hierarchical patron-client relationship, and it's not really compatible with the idea of common ownership. But nevertheless, it's a non-exchange. There are no market prices operate in that idealist kind of setup. Goods are simply redistributed from the center to the periphery without being exchanged, simply to reinforce the existing power structure. Of course, this couldn't apply in socialism. And socialism, what socialists have in mind is something obviously quite different, namely the free appropriation of goods according to self-determined need without any quid pro quo exchange being involved. Socialism is often misunderstood as redistribution, and this is, you know, redistributing wealth, and this is why I draw this distinction between free access and the kind of model that Polanyi is talking about. Anyway, that's what we mean by free access. Now, the logical corollary of free access is freely associated voluntary labor. The one thing implies the other. How could labor be coerced if goods and services are made freely available? Conversely, if labor was free, meaning performed on a voluntary basis, how could the products of labor take the form of commodities? So a socialist society would operate according to the old socialist slogan, from each according to one's ability, to each according to one's need. This means there's the direct link between one's labor input and what one consumes will be severed. I want to look quickly at two aspects of the organization of work in socialism as Marx saw it, before going on finally to discuss the viability of the social arrangement I've just outlined. These are firstly his idea of a system of labor vouchers, and secondly, his views concerning the division of labor in socialism. Now, I've got serious reservations on both these points. Just to take the idea of labour vouchers first. In his critique of the Gotha program, Marx saw this as being applicable only to what he called the first phase of communism or socialism. This was when there was not enough wealth to go around, and he reasoned some form of rationing would be needed. In the second or higher phase, however, this would not be required. To quote Marx, in a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labor, and therewith also the antithesis between mental and physical labor has vanished, after labor has become not only a means of life, but life's prime want, after the productive forces have also increased with the all-round development of the individual, and all the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizon of bourgeois right be crossed in its entirety, and society inscribed on its from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. Now, incidentally, his comment, after labor has become not only a means of life, but life's prime want. This actually calls into question the whole distinction Marx makes between the realm of necessity and the realm of freedom. It also makes it much more difficult to differentiate between what we might call leisure and work. Anyway, the point is that Marx argued that where there is scarcity, there tends to be a competitive struggle for resources, which is a fair point. He felt that this could potentially undermine socialism, so to contain this threat, some form of equitable rationing is required. Hence the idea of labor vouchers, which would make the appropriation of goods conditional upon one's contribution to production. These vouchers, Marx stressed, are not money, as they don't circulate, and also there's no exchange of goods between the producers themselves. So it's not like capitalism, but it's still nevertheless somewhat removed from the system of free access and voluntary labor we usually associate with socialism. Now, there are many problems with this proposal, and I'll just quickly run through them. Firstly, I think it's obsolete in that it presupposes a condition of scarcity that may have been true in the late 19th century, but it's no longer the case today. Today, scarcity has to be enforced rather than endured. Secondly, there's the problem of how exactly one measures the labor input of a worker. For example, is 1 hour's work performed by a street cleaner going to be rewarded the same as 1 hour's work performed by a neurosurgeon? If not, then by how much more would you pay one compared to the other? Either way, this could create social tensions when different individuals doing different jobs start to make comparisons. Thirdly, it also it makes no sense to just issue labor vouchers without also pricing goods in terms of their labor content, how much labor it took to make them. The problem is labor time accounting is hugely problematic for several reasons, which I won't go into here, but we can maybe discuss later. Finally, there's the sheer scale of the administrative bureaucracy required to administer the system, including, of course, the close surveillance of the workers themselves. I think this will create opportunities for corruption to creep in, which could undermine the social cohesion of a socialist society. I don't deny that there may well be some need for rationing in the early days of socialism, but I suggest there are more effective ways of rationing than a generalized system of rationing through labour vouchers. These would focus on the specific goods in short supply and involve a much more simplified approach that doesn't require the pricing of goods in any way. The other point about Marx's observations on work and socialism I find questionable has to do with his thoughts on the division of labour. In the quote I gave, Marx talks of getting rid of the, quote, enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labour. But what are we to make of this? At first glance, this seems to contradict his labour voucher proposal, since the payment of vouchers seems to imply some sort of ongoing contractual relationship with your workplace that monitors your labour inputs. It's not exactly the kind of freedom to move from one job to another that one would imagine. Now, it's important to understand that there are different ways in which we can talk about the division of labour. Firstly, there is the social division of labour, which refers to the many numerous occupations people perform to enable a complex modern society to function. Secondly, it's the technical division of labour, which is what happens inside a production unit and focuses on the different processes involved in producing some final product. This is, incidentally, what Adam Smith was referring to when he gave his famous example of the pin factory. And then finally, there's the territorial division of labour or regional specialisation. For example, while it's technically feasible to grow bananas in the Antarctic, it's hugely expensive, obviously. And so it makes much more sense to grow them where they grow best, naturally, for example, in the subtropics. So what did Marx have to say on the subject? He did not deny that there would be a social division of labour in a socialist society in the sense of a range of occupations. There's that famous quote from the German ideology where he talks of the individual in communism being able to hunt, rear cattle, fish, or criticise after dinner without ever becoming just a hunter, fisherman, or critic, as in capitalism. Now, I don't doubt that come socialism, we will each be able to engage in a much wider variety of jobs than we do today. We won't be constrained by some employment contract to what Marx called a particular exclusive sphere of activity. Variety, as they say, is the spice of life. But how far do we take this argument? For instance, we can't all become a neurosurgeon, and it wouldn't be sensible to even try. It takes years of study to become one, and while there won't be any particular economic barrier to becoming one, the vast majority of us won't. A neurosurgeon is a specialized form of work. This can be contrasted with generalist work that anybody can do. In socialism, I imagine we'll have a mixture of both specialist and generalist work. Someone engaged in specialist work will also quite likely engage in generalist work and vice versa. So there will be a division of labour, but it would not be forced in the sense Marx meant, but rather spontaneous. Thankfully, we are all different as individuals. And as individuals, we should be able to develop what interests us most. Apart from anything else, people are more productive when they're doing what most enthuses them. Now, the problem with Marx's view on the subject is that he tended to think there would only be generalists in socialism and no specialists, which I think is not very realistic. In his book, Farewell to the Working Class, André Gorce maintains that Marx thought it was a precondition of socialism that workers should become fully rounded, polytechnic workers capable of doing any particular kind of work that society needed doing. Here's the relevant passage from the German ideology. The collective appropriation of the productive forces, says Marx, involves, nothing more than the development of the individual capacities corresponding to the material instruments of production. The appropriation of a totality of instruments of production is for this very reason the development of a totality of capacities in the individuals themselves. So there we have it. According to Marx, individuals must develop a totality of capacities or become multi-skilled or polytechnic in order to establish and maintain a socialist society. Marx seems to have felt that just possessing some particular skills and not others limits the horizon of workers and prevents them from seeing their situation from a class-wide perspective. We have to be able to, as it were, put ourselves in the shoes of our fellow workers and to be able to do what they can do. Now, I think this argument is nonsense, frankly, but according to Gauss, there's a certain logic to it. The factory system, as it developed in the early 19th century, produced a proletariat that was broken and brutalized, or as Marx called it, mere appendages to the machine. It left workers psychologically scarred and unready to mount a socialist revolution. From around the mid-19th century, however, we saw the emergence of a distinct stratum of skilled workers who formed some of the earliest trade unions. Marx saw this as a positive development and hoped it would grow to encompass the working class in general, or as Gauss puts it, quote, he anticipated a process in which the development of the productive forces would result in the replacement of the army of unskilled workers and laborers, and the conditions of military discipline in which they worked by a class of polytechnic, manually and intellectually skilled workers who would have a comprehensive understanding of the entire work process, control complex technical systems, and move with ease from one type of work to another. Unquote. The problem is that developments didn't quite pan out in the way Marx hoped. In fact, they moved in quite the opposite direction. The rise of mass production and the assembly line system called Fordism brought about mass de-skilling. Work was reduced to a few simple maneuvers repeated over and over again to keep pace with the assembly line itself. It increased productivity, but at the same time, it ensured that work would remain an essentially alien form of activity. Or as Gauss says, quote, these means of productions are not merely neutral mechanical devices. They embody capitalist relations of domination and exercise their command over working people in the form of inflexible technical requirements. Unquote. So, although the development of industry was putting in place preconditions for socialism by raising the level of productivity, this came about at a heavy price. That is, it prevented the possibility of full socialism coming into being because of the way technology structured the very nature of work itself. That being so, it was impossible to transform work from coerced labor into free labor. And of course, that meant the wages system would have to remain a permanent feature of the industrial landscape, although its importance would diminish over time as more and more jobs succumb to automation. Or to put it in Marx's terms, the realm of necessity would shrink as a result of the reduction in the working day, bringing about an expansion in the realm of freedom, providing workers more and more free time. Well, as we've seen, the leisure society hasn't materialized under capitalism, and there doesn't seem to be much chance that it will. But also, I think Gorse's claim concerning the technical requirements of modern industry imposing the need for wage labor to coerce workers into doing certain jobs is utterly mechanistic, reductionist, and simplistic. This is not only because it overlooks the potential for retooling technology in more user-friendly ways, something that's incidentally is already happening to an extent under capitalism with information technology, but also I suggest it grossly understates the extent of human adaptability. So I want to just end here by listing some of the key arguments to show that a system of voluntary labor is eminently feasible. Firstly, we might as well start with Marx's point about how, quote, the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labor under capitalism, unquote, forces each individual to stick to a particular job. In socialism, of course, this will no longer apply, meaning that for any job that needs doing, that is not being done, there would be, so to speak, a reserve or a reservoir of labor in depth to cover that particular job. So socialism will have a much more flexible and adaptable system compared to today, when you can't just switch from one job to another as you please. Secondly, one reason we experience work as something unpleasant, as suggested earlier, has to do with the sheer length of the working day. All things being equal, the longer the working day, the more it feels like a burden, and also the less variety that it offers. But here's the point, that socialism will make possible a very substantial reduction in the per capita workload of society, and hence the length of the working day. There are numerous occupations or products today that would simply cease to exist in socialism because they serve no purpose in a society where production is solely geared to meeting human needs. To take just one small example, in America, the total number of employees in the commercial banking sector alone comes to just over 1.5 million. Banking is not only unproductive in capitalist terms, but it's also completely socially useless in human terms, and it simply won't exist in socialism. Furthermore, the number of bank employees is just the visible tip of the iceberg of this whole structural waste of resources. For example, banks need to be housed in sometimes very lavish, expensive buildings. So part of the construction industry is also implicated in the structural waste of banking. The same argument would apply for all the facilities and equipment that banks use, from, you know, a hole-in-the-wall cash dispensers to sophisticated computer networks. But note that bank employees are just a tiny fraction, full extent of socially useless jobs in capitalism, which would disappear in socialism. If you look through official websites like the Bureau of Labor Statistics in America, you can get quite a good idea of the full extent of this. Conservatively speaking, at least half the jobs currently done in the formal sector today would no longer be required in socialism. In de facto terms, that translates into a very substantial reduction in the per capita workload. However, we need to qualify this claim, and this brings me to my third key argument. We're talking about dispensing with at least half the work currently done in the monetized economy. In other words, half of all currently paid work. But according to a publication entitled Unpaid Work in the Global Economy, I've given a link to that in the link sections, by the way. In terms of total hours worked, there's a greater volume of non-remunerated work than of remunerated work on a global scale. And this includes all kinds of unpaid work, subsistence farmers, the household economy, charitable work, community-based projects, and so on. The sheer extent of this work, even under capitalism, is something that further undermines the claim that individuals are unlikely to work without the inducement of some form of remuneration, money incentive. So we arrive at the fourth point, that it's not work per se that's the problem, but rather the terms and conditions under which we, under which people work, something I mentioned earlier. Socialism will have both the incentive and the means to significantly improve working conditions. The objection sometimes made, for instance, who will do the work, the dirty work under socialism? One answer is that this kind of work could be largely automated or done by robots. For instance, for some peculiar reason, the question of cleaning sewers always seems to crop up here, which probably says more about the questioner than the problem of cleaning sewers itself. But as a matter of fact, there are now some very large-scale automated systems for cleaning and monitoring complex sewage systems in many cities around the world. But apart from that, the question, who will do the dirty work, begs another question. See, people are all different. What is unpleasant for one may be a source of great pleasure for another, and this too will work to socialism's advantage. So on to argument number five. It's often said that volunteers make the best workers. In the literature, what drives them is called intrinsic motivation. I've also posted a link on this if you're interested in the link section. The point is that studies have shown that far from motivating people, so-called money incentives actually tend to undermine people's intrinsic motivation. We need to be able to express ourselves and be creative in some way. This is arguably something built into our psychic makeup. The how we express ourselves is obviously something conditioned by the kind of society we live in. Thorstein Veblen called this impulse to be creative an instinct for workmanship. We deteriorate mentally and physically when we have nothing to do. Boredom and depression set in. This is why even the super rich, who don't have to lift a finger work-wise, fling themselves into all sorts of creative pursuits. Multi-billionaires still find the need to engage in work as CEOs of the companies they own. This brings us to a sixth argument in favor of a system of voluntary labor. Here I want to focus on the esteem and respect accorded to us by our peers. According to the psychologist Abraham Maslow, who developed the concept of a hierarchy of needs, there are five basic categories of needs we are all subject to. These are physiological, safety, love, esteem, self-actualization needs. Here's an example. Between 1924 and 1934, there was a landmark study in the history of motivational research carried out by a researcher called Elton Mayo. This was called the Hawthorne studies named after the factory in Chicago where the actual experiments were carried out. The object of the exercise was to discover whether the comparatively recent innovation of electrical lighting in fact enhance productivity. So a small group of female assembly workers were selected as a test team on which to carry out the experiment. Not surprisingly, researchers found that productivity did indeed rise, but then when they later sought to verify their findings by dimming the lights to see if the opposite happened, they were surprised to find that productivity continued to increase. And Mayer concluded that the test team were actually responding to the attention they had received from his researchers by way of positive reinforcement. In short, people appreciate being appreciated. And of course, in socialism, people will continue to be appreciated for their contribution to society, probably far more so than today. This is because today there is a more important indicator of status based on what one takes out of society in the form of conspicuous consumption that actually cuts across and undermines the esteem we attach to work contribution. Why, for example, are hospital cleaners held in such low regard when they perform such a vital job while celebrities make the front page for the most pathetically trivial of reasons? In socialism, this particular route to status acquisition, if you can call it that, based on the accumulation of wealth, will be completely blocked off or rendered meaningless in a society where goods and services will be free to own. So the focus will tend to be almost entirely on what one gives to society instead. Those who argue that socialism would collapse due to the problem of freeloaders need to explain how are people going to gratify this very deep-seated need to feel valued and esteemed by their fellows. There's an interesting article written by Tony Gibson in 1952 entitled "Who Will Do the Dirty Work?" which makes what I thought was quite a perceptive point. In the newly established state of Israel, Gibson noted that with the high rate of new migrants to Israel, there was a superabundance of professional workers like lawyers and so on, but a dire shortage of manual workers. What happened subsequently was that both the social prestige and the relative pay of manual work rose significantly compared to professional work, quite unlike in other parts of the world. So what we had was a situation where the, if you like, the supply and demand for different kinds of labor influenced the distribution of social prestige itself. And I would suggest that some kind of mechanism analogous to this might well operate in a socialist society as well. At any rate, it'll be quite an effective way of dealing with the question of who will do the dirty work in socialism. To the extent that such work remains undone, the prestige gained by doing such work is likely to rise vis-a-vis other work. And so, in a sense, the problem will solve itself. I want to round off this talk now with a seventh final key argument. I've contrasted free labor based on one's voluntary contribution to society to coerced labor, which is the form of labor applicable to class-based societies. However, there is a sense in which free labor might also entail a kind of coercion too, namely moral coercion. The basic difference is that coerced labor involves external sanctions, whereas free labor does not. In socialism, you're not punished for example, for slacking off or skiving. As I said, the link between what you consume and your labor input is severed. The expression, he who does not work, neither shall he eat, comes from the second epistle of St. Paul to the Thessalonians in the New Testament. And it's quite ironic that this same principle is enshrined in that preeminently godless constitution, the Soviet Union of 1936. Thus, Article 12 of the Constitution states, in the USSR, work is a duty and a matter of honor for every able-bodied citizen in accordance with the principle, he does not work, neither shall he eat. But in the socialist society, though no one will be penalized for not working, they will undoubtedly still feel a sense of duty or, if you like, moral obligation towards others. That is, they will still feel concern for the well-being and welfare of others, not just themselves. Actually, no society could function without some degree of altruistic sentiment, not even capitalism. As the famous French sociologist Emile Durkheim pointed out, society itself is essentially a moral order. His nephew, Marcel Mauss, developed this point further in a classic text called The Gift, which he wrote in 1925. Looking at traditional societies like the Maoris in New Zealand, he analyzed the kind of reciprocal relationships that applied in this society based on the idea of the gift. Now, gifting has a very different dynamic to commodity exchange, as I mentioned earlier. Gifts seek to cement social relationships and bind people together in a network of mutual and ongoing obligations. Commodities, by contrast, separate and atomize individuals into separate parties with opposing interests in the form of buyers and sellers. So, in a sense, socialism can be described as a global gift economy, although the term economy is perhaps not quite the right word here, since the transactions that we're talking about are essentially moral, not economic. The particular form of reciprocity that interests us as socialists is what we call generalized reciprocity, not balanced reciprocity. Generalized, which basically means gift-giving without any expectation of an immediate return, as in balanced reciprocity. An example of this is what normally goes on in the family household. So the members of the family will muck in, do the household chores without any expectation of being paid for it. Critics of socialism will acknowledge that this kind of communistic setup is feasible on a small scale, as in the family or within hunter-gatherer bands, but they argue that you can't possibly scale this up. You can't, you know, on a large scale. But actually, it's simply not the case. Even today, there are many real-world examples of large-scale generalized reciprocity, as in the tradition of hospitality towards strangers practiced by cultures such as the Bedouin in Africa or the Inuit, and so on. The internet itself has been compared to a gigantic gift economy, and it's quite amusing. Critics of socialism will often be found spending countless hours of their own free time on internet forums, completely unpaid, I should add, trying to argue that there's just no way anyone would undertake work like researching a topic or writing up a lengthy debate contribution for the benefit of complete strangers, unless there was some financial reward for doing so. So there are multiple reasons why people work, even when they don't regard what they're doing as work, as, for example, on the internet. In socialism, one of these reasons will be a sense of mutual obligation, feeling one another based on the understanding that we all depend on each other. There's no way you can establish socialism and maintain it unless people accept the basic rules of the game, so to speak. There will be no nanny state to complain to or whinge about when the potholes start appearing in the road or the piles of rubbish start mounting up, and you can't physically force other people to do this, so to satisfy your own needs. People will understand this, and that is the whole point, isn't it? Everybody will understand this in setting out to establish a socialist society. It sort of goes with the territory, to speak. So, to conclude, socialism creates, if you like, the optimum conditions in which a sense of personal responsibility and maturity can emerge, unlike capitalism. It's capitalism that actually generates feelings of dependency. By contrast, capitalism, in a sense, it almost infantilizes us and tempts us into constantly passing on the buck, often in the hope of making a fast buck for ourselves out of maybe litigating against responsible. So the very establishment of socialism presupposes people have embraced the kind of values that will ensure society will function in the way they want to. They want it to. That said, even under capitalism, people do respond to adverse circumstances or human tragedies with an enormous generosity of spirit. And I want to end off here with a quote from an article in The Guardian in April last year, as follows. In the space of a few weeks of coronavirus lockdown, England has acquired a million-strong network of social volunteers, surpassing demand and prompting speculation. Is this a new sign of social solidarity? And can the newly acquired community spirit survive? So, if that can happen in capitalism, imagine the possibilities in socialism. Thanks.